embarksustain.org and follow along on Instagram at embarksustain.
The staff and volunteers at CJSF wish you the best for the new year.
Today on Wings.
Guatsi helpa, duhiname itzatuitsa shui mihanu. Good afternoon, everyone. I'm honored to welcome you to the Department of the Interior, which sits on the ancestral homelands of the Anacostan and Piscataway people. Land acknowledgments recognize the Indigenous people who are the original stewards of the lands where we live and work.
That's U.S. Secretary of the Interior Deb Haaland, the first Native American U.S. Cabinet Secretary. In 2022, she set in motion an investigation into the history of federal, quote, boarding schools that were used to strip away Native cultures from Indigenous children during both the 19th and the 20th centuries.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Again, U.S. Secretary of the Interior Deb Haaland.
I come from ancestors who endured the horrors of the Indian boarding school assimilation policies carried out by the same department that I now lead. This department was responsible for operating what we now know to be 408 federal boarding schools across 37 states or then territories, including 21 schools in Alaska and 7 schools in Hawaii. Now we are uniquely positioned to assist in the effort to recover the dark history of these institutions that have haunted our families for too long.
Haaland is a member of the Pueblo of Laguna. The ancestral territory of her people includes the southwest corner of the state of Colorado. Colorado lawmakers voted funds in 2022 for a year of research into the so-called boarding schools in their state. The state historical agency History Colorado released the results in October 2023. Shannon Young reports.
Come here.
A tour guide brings a group of teachers and students through a museum exhibit that blends futuristic multimedia art with ancient Puebloan pottery and a lesson about a 17th century indigenous uprising.
It is very abstract. But I have had fourth graders be like, oh, that reminds me of Wakanda. And I'm like, great, you know exactly what we're trying to do here. You totally get this idea of like this.
The exhibit is part of a new, more consultative approach by Colorado's State History Institute to bring overlooked and suppressed history into public view. That includes digging into histories of violent displacements and forced assimilations targeting indigenous populations. Holly Norton is Colorado's state archaeologist. She led the year-long investigation into federal Indian boarding schools in Colorado, operating between 1880 and 1920.
Schools in the United States for Native youth and Native people in general have existed since colonial times. Education has always been a facet of that colonial project of assimilation and attempting to conquer this continent. By 1880, what we call the Indian Wars are essentially over. And most, if not every, tribe in the United States has been removed to a reservation. So by the 1880s, schools are starting here in Colorado. A couple of thousand children went through these institutions over this 40-year period. We also had to refine how many schools there were. We ultimately identified 9 institutions that were federally supported, 2 that were off-reservation boarding schools, the way that people typically think of them when they imagine these schools, Fort Lewis Indian Boarding School had approximately 1,100 children, and the Grand Junction Indian School, which was also known as the Teller Institute, had approximately 600 students enrolled during its existence.
There were a handful of lesser schools in what is now the Denver metro area. Some were reform schools. Another was an institution for the deaf and blind, where at least four Indigenous students ended up after losing their eyesight or hearing as a result of trachoma, a bacterial infection contracted at boarding schools. State archaeologist Holly Norton says the 1920 cutoff date was chosen for a couple of reasons.
First and foremost, as we were getting into the research, there was so much documentation and the history was so complicated. And we did have that condensed timeline that I made the executive decision as the lead of this project that we had to have a cutoff date so that we could have a substantive product at the end of this legislation. When that decision was made, the hope in the conversation was that this is not finished, right? That this is something that we can come back to. 1920 is a good cutoff date for a couple of reasons. Beginning in the 20s, we start to see some changes in federal Indian policy that affected federal Indian education. And then the second reason why 1920 is a really good cutoff is the primary question going into the research was trying to identify students. Speaking with archival experts, such as the archivists at the National Archives in D.C., our own archivist here at History Colorado, 1920 is often seen as a privacy cutoff date. And beyond that, we can potentially get into living or really recent individuals' private history that could be harmful or painful. And so when we do this research beyond 1920, we need to approach it very sensitively, very carefully, and mindfully of those privacy concerns so that we're not reharming any of the families who've endured these boarding schools for the last century.
Many families of boarding school alumni are the ones at the forefront of pushing for the truth to come out. Among them is attorney Geraldine DeCoto, enrolled member of the Turtle Mountain Chippewa. Both of her parents attended boarding schools from an early age. She says the Colorado investigation is a good start, but more work is needed.
I think it's really well done. I think it's sensitively done. It's thorough. It encourages further exploration of particular issues that are really quite important. And mostly what I was impressed with was that there was a decision made not to do the oral histories, the oral interviews, out of consideration for all the considerations around oral histories, you know, what they mean to the boarding school survivors and their descendants, the families, the communities, and how that needs to be handled with some sensitivity before just assuming that, you know, the state should have all those stories for, you know, whatever reason, for progeny, for their collections. And I'm amazed at the way they put all the information together and really seem to have a grasp of what they don't know, what they don't have information about.
The legislation that prompted and funded the Colorado boarding school investigation did originally include a directive to gather oral histories. But the lead researcher argued the one-year timeline was too tight to carry out the work in a sensitive and consultative way. Instead, the team had to rely on other methods like official school correspondence, periodical research, ledgers, and other archives.
I wasn't surprised to find that they don't have much information and that they had to piece this information together from crazy sources like newspaper articles rather than official reports. There was such a lack of any kind of organized reporting or feedback that it was almost just up to individual schools to say what they wanted to say. usually in narrative style reports, which I've read quite a few of those kinds of documents, and they are interesting. And you would think because they're narrative style that they might contain some information that was more informative about the way the kids' lives were in school, but it almost like information that could be put on a chart or a spreadsheet or something. Like we talked about how many potatoes the kids ate rather than how they felt about having their hair cut off, probably before they could even speak a word of English to say anything about it.
Geraldine DeCoto knows well how little information is out there regarding the true extent of the Native American boarding school experience. More than a decade ago, she co-founded the National Native American Boarding School Healing Coalition.
Yeah, I mean, I was aware that my parents went to boarding school, although they didn't really talk about it, really didn't know much about their stories. My mother died when she was 47. So I didn't really get to talk to her very much about her boarding school experience before she died. My dad lived much longer, so we were able to talk to him a little bit and gain some other understanding. But the boarding school issue really became accessible to me, I think, when we had a symposium in Boulder, coordinated by the Native American Rights Fund and the University of Colorado, on boarding schools in the United States and boarding school healing. And we invited some of the Canadian commissioners who had conducted the boarding school research up there, Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And they were just at the end of that process and might have even been before they published their 94, whatever that number was, findings and recommendations. But they came, and we created the National Native American Boarding School Healing Coalition. And I was a founding board member and then served as the president for, I think, about 6 years. And then I was termed out. And by that time, there was enough interest generated that we were getting more board members and more young people, which was a good thing. Anyways, that is where I prepared my first boarding school presentations. And of course, it's morphed. There's several generations of what I talk to people about now, but I've been sharing the history of boarding schools and my own family's history for many, many years now. And I do enjoy doing that, although it's not easy to do. So forming the National Native American Boarding School Healing Coalition, I think, was absolutely critical to getting the broader story told, to getting the national attention. There are lots of things that aided that. Like I said, the Canadian Truth and Reconciliation Commission, and of course, Deb Haaland becoming the Secretary of the Interior in the discovery of those 215 bodies at Kamloops in British Columbia. All of these things lit a fire in the consciousness of people, I think, in the United States. There's so much now. There's so many films, there's so many books, there's so many opportunities to learn.
You are listening to Wings, the Women's International News Gathering Service. I'm Shannon Young. Today, we're looking at the state of Colorado's investigation into so-called federal Indian boarding schools from 1880 to 1920. The one-year investigation was the result of a state law passed in 2022. We're hearing from Colorado State Archaeologist Dr. Holly Norton, who led the investigation, as well as Geraldine DeCoto, co-founder of the National Native American Boarding School Healing Coalition. By the 1880s, the Cheyenne and Arapaho tribes had already been forced off their traditional lands in Colorado into reservations in Wyoming and in Oklahoma. The Southern Ute and Ute Mountain Ute tribes continued to reside in portions of ancestral lands in southwestern and western Colorado, respectively. State archaeologist Holly Norton says Colorado's largest boarding schools were intended for Ute children, but their parents resisted sending their children in large numbers.
I think what was less understood, at least by, you know, white academics like myself, I think this was probably more understood by my Ute colleagues, is the level of resistance that the Ute had to these schools in 1880, 1890, into the 20th century. The Ute really stood steadfast, keeping their children out of school or pulling them out whenever there was the first indication that something was not going well in these schools or that their kids were in danger or in harm's way.
Colorado's state-level investigation into the federal system of Native American boarding schools found that 31 students died at the Fort Lewis School and another 37 individuals died at the Grand Junction School. This information came from archival research, but the team also conducted studies using non-invasive ground-penetrating radar. Norton says that before determining how to move forward with the investigation, she looked closely at work already underway in both the U.S. and in Canada.
Canada has really been at the forefront in some ways, and there is some really good both published and unpublished best practices that have come out, especially for geophysical work. Another investigation that's actually still currently ongoing that I looked closely at and that I talked to colleagues is the Tulsa Race Massacre investigations.
The Tulsa Race Massacre occurred in the state of Oklahoma in 1921. Over the span of 2 days, white mobs rampaged through the city's Greenwood District, nicknamed Black Wall Street. The assailants killed around 300 black residents and burned down more than 35 city blocks. It's another suppressed chapter of U.S. history that is coming to light more than a century later. Colorado State archaeologist Holly Norton says she hopes her team's methodology for archival research has added to the suite of tools.
There was already some best practices for geophysical work laid out by my Canadian colleagues. One of the things that I've tried to elucidate to complement that is the complexities of archival research. I think still today, a lot of people think you can just walk into the National Archives and there's the big book of boarding schools and all of your questions are answered. Archival work is super complex, right? It's much more complex than that. That's why we rely on archivists. They're experts and they're our colleagues in helping us not only find the information, but also helping us to translate it. Like, what is this type of document? What does it mean? Why do we have this document and not this other document? How do things get stored? And all of these are really important questions that you have to understand and that you have to answer before you can say, I have this information and this is what it's telling me. So I don't know if I succeeded, but I was really hoping to kind of lay out the strengths and weaknesses of archival research in the report so that the general public would understand. You know, if someone is trying to understand their grandmother's experience at one of these schools and they don't understand why they can't find them in a document or that this document says X, Y, and Z, I'm hoping that my report can give them some insight into how those documents were created.
One of the historical records providing insight into a pattern of abuse was a series of investigative reports published in 1903 by the Denver Post. The series focused on allegations against Thomas Breen, who was the superintendent of the Fort Lewis School for nearly a decade. While Breen never faced charges, the Denver Post detailed multiple allegations of sexual and physical abuse targeting women and girls at the school, as well as neglect, starvation, unsanitary conditions, and embezzlement of funds. Another practice the History Colorado researchers were able to document using historical records was that of the so-called outing program.
It was framed as an apprenticeship, but I think that that's too soft of an idea. Once children were in these industrial and agricultural schools for a few years, and they learned a set of skills. Then they were sent off to live with white families. Girls and women were sent to live as domestics, and so they would cook and clean and do childcare for families, ostensibly for a wage. We know, at least in Colorado, sometimes those wages were withheld from students and they never saw them. Boys and men were sent to work in fields to do heavy agricultural labor. Back east, where the schools were more industrial and factory focused, then they would be sent to apprentice in various industries. But in almost every case, all of these jobs were incredibly difficult labor. They were the lowest rung of the socioeconomic ladder. And that was the extent of the expectations for these children. They were not trained to be doctors or nurses or teachers.
Norton says her big takeaway from the year-long investigation into the history of federal Indian boarding schools in Colorado is how they were just one piece of a larger set of interlocking policies.
I think what really struck me in this research was how insidious federal Indian policy was in the late 19th, the early 20th century, and I'm sure that there are plenty of scholars who know a lot more than I do who would say through the 20th century and into today. We often think of these boarding schools or these other historical Native policies in these compartmentalized way, but they were all related. And the different ways that the federal government, that state governments, that local community members just really abused, oppressed, stole from our Native community was embedded in our legal system. All of these things are related, and just seeing these kind of tendrils of assimilation and oppression through all of these different sorts of policies that were ultimately related is something that has really struck me, and I think that is important for us to think about as we move forward and we talk about reconciliation. What are we reconciling? How are we reconciling these past grievances and atrocities? And what does it mean to find ways to support our Native communities and build back healthier relationships between state and tribal governments?
Those are questions Turtle Mountain Chippewa attorney Geralyn Dakoto has spent many years pondering and working to answer through involvement in numerous organizations.
I really do feel like awareness is changing, the truth is being told, the stories are being shared. And I don't know that we're there yet as far as healing, but we're getting there. And I know that one of the recent things, and I don't know how much money it was, a couple million dollars or something, that's being devoted to gathering oral histories. I think that will be done well and correctly. NABS, the National Native and Boarding School Healing Coalition, was, I think, awarded that money to do this. So I think that they will do a careful job, a sensitive job. There will be, you know, emotional, psychological support for the people who are willing to participate in that kind of an effort. But that will be another chapter in learning about the boarding school history. And I think then some healing can come. Personally, what I think is probably the most important thing to help with healing is language revitalization, teaching young people the language. In one generation, in my family, my mother and father were both fluent Ojibwe and Cree speakers, and none of us of their kids has any fluency at all beyond a word or two. I mean, that's one generation gone. But I think the exciting thing that's happening is that younger people are learning the language in more formal settings and also with elders. And they're teaching kind of this couple of generations that got sandwiched in between, or we didn't learn our language. So my daughter is a teacher at Ojibwa school, K through 8, and she is going to get certified at our tribal college to teach Ojibwe. And there is a whole cohort of teachers that they're offering this to. And they're going to teach the kids. And I really think that that's going to help us reconnect with our cultures in the most meaningful way. I really do. Language is that critical. But that being said, each tribe, each individual, for survivor and each tribal community has to decide for itself how it wants to pursue healing.
Shortly after releasing the findings of the year-long investigation, Colorado State archaeologist Holly Norton says she hopes they serve as a basis for further research into the issue and a better understanding of state history.
Now that this portion of the report is finished, I think that we need to have more conversations and consultations with community. So what we'd like to do in the near future and moving forward is have consultations, both the government-to-government tribal consultations, as well as community conversations with communities who are descendants of or impacted by this history. And I think that future steps are going to have to come from those communities. What are their needs and wants and desires for work moving forward? And that might be the oral history scope of work that we have ready to try to implement. That might be more research from 1920 on. That might be more research into some of these questions like you've asked me today. But I think we're prepared to kind of sit back a little bit and hear that from communities before rushing forward and making these decisions ourselves.
Recovery and restoration of what was lost or taken requires knowledge, be that of a native language or of traditional practices. Legal expert Geraldine Dakota, who is now a grandmother, says she does feel progress is being made in the right direction. And a lot of it has to do with how suppressed history is becoming common knowledge.
I feel like there's a shift after all these years of doing this with the community. I feel like there's progress, and I feel like we have a language. So when we say things like boarding schools and intergenerational trauma, taking of land, illegal removal of tribes, people understand what we're talking about.
For the Women's International News Gathering Service, I'm Shannon Young in Boulder, Colorado.
While the Colorado researchers did not feel prepared to collect oral histories during their one-year time frame, U.S. Secretary of the Interior Deb Haaland has expressed commitment to that next step.
As a Pueblo woman, it is my responsibility, and frankly, it's my legacy. As part of the Federal Indian Boarding School Initiative and in response to recommendations from the report, I will travel across the country to use my platform to elevate American Indian, Alaska Native, and Native Hawaiian survivors of the Federal Indian Boarding School System and give them the opportunity to share their stories, help connect communities with trauma-informed support, and facilitate the collection of a permanent oral history. This is one step among many that we will take.
Wings thanks our supporters, including your local community radio stations, Suzette Cullen and Genevieve Vaughn, editor of the book Women and the Gift Economy. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle is Cast. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
He could be 30. He could be 50. Life has aged him beyond his years. A shopping cart carries everything he owns. Here he comes, toward you. What you think you know about how he got here is probably wrong.
Don't let homelessness assumptions get in the way of homelessness solutions. Go to CanadaCanDoIt.ca. Help the Canadian Alliance to End Homelessness.